Welcome to the Round Rock Church of Christ Teaching Podcast. We're a faith community located in the central Austin area that gathers at 8:30 a.m. and 11 a.m. on Sunday mornings. We hope this teaching blesses you as we become spirit-filled and spirit-led Jesus followers for those who do not have a home.
Good morning, church. Are we ready to get after it this morning? All right. Ruth chapter 3, if you got a physical Bible with you this morning, I would encourage you to turn to it if you are brave enough for this passage that we're about to be on. I want to go ahead and name something that's been slowly leaking out that I want to confirm. There's a rumor that I enjoy shopping, and I want to confirm that that rumor is actually very true, but you don't know how deep it actually is for me. Usually in social context, if someone's like, oh man, we gotta go shopping, I like secretly inside, I'm like, I'm game, I'm ready for it. I like searching for deals. I enjoy that, but I downplay it all the time. And here's how deep it goes for me. I really love hunting gifts down for people. So what I will do is after every Christmas, hey, we're in a series called Home at Last, glad you're here. I will find gifts that are trending across America just to get ideas for different gifts that I can buy people. So I've got a couple pictures for you of things that you missed out on giving your loved ones this past year. One, this dog bed, that was a huge thing. Okay, you can store the bone, it's handy. I don't resonate with it, but other people do. Second is Legos released this succulent like line. So if you got plant people in your life, you buy them some Legos, you can store it. Some of you are like, are we doing this right now? Here's another one. This is called the Comfy Cozy. This was a big item this year. Half of you are going to go do this in your homes because it's so cold after church. And the last one, I put this not because I affirm it, but because I judge it. And it's this. This was trending this year. I would like to note two things. One, why do you have this many Stanley cups? You should receive prayer if you have this many cups. And second of all, it holds straws. That feels extra to me. It just doesn't feel necessary. Those are some of the things that trended this past year. One of them that caught my attention, though, that I greatly appreciated and was surprised by, was this company called StoryWorth. If you're unfamiliar with it, it's not a product-based company. It's actually a practice company, a subscription practice. What you do is you sign up a loved one, and they will send daily prompts to your loved one, just one single question. You'll answer that question, and then at the end of the year, it takes all of these small stories, collects them together, and writes one large story out of it. In the midst of all of these kind of plastic, maybe shallow, maybe impractical gifts, there's one that lies in seeing that there is something about the small stuff that makes a good story. I want you to hold on to that. Like I said, we're in a series called Home at Last, and we've been walking through the book of Ruth as we ask the question of how do we gain a sense of home. Our vision that we've laid out as a church is we've said we want to be Jesus followers who are spirit-filled and spirit-led for those who do not have a home. So therefore, we're taking weeks on end talking about what's it mean to have a sense of home. Where do you place that? Last week, I used the analogy of if you've ever built something from IKEA, someone may walk into your house, look at that IKEA piece and be like, that thing is beautiful. But only you inside, the homeowner, the one who put that thing together, knows the labor and the work and the behind-the-scene work and yelling that went into putting that item together. The Lord's house is kind of like the same. You may come on a Sunday morning and see something beautiful, but there's work that goes behind the scenes. In week one, we talked about the question of what do you do when you lose your sense of home? In week two, we talked about how do you find that sense of home. And in week three, the question I want to answer, if my microphone holds on, the question I want to answer is simply, am I going to be okay? I feel like I'm in danger right now. The question I want to answer, the third one is, what will God do if you actually engage and drink deeply from this home. So Luke chapter 3, if you got your Bible open with you, we've been talking about how Ruth is this book that it's titled Ruth, but it's actually a story about Ruth's mother-in-law, Naomi, who in the very beginning of the story loses all three things that give a sense of home. Food, there's a famine in the land, she's kicked out of her home, that she loses family, she loses not only her husband, but also her two sons. She's left with her two daughter-in-laws, one of them being Ruth. And then finally, there is no son that comes from either of those daughter-in-laws. So their future is scary and it's up in the air. And just so we're clear, we're not just talking about one human's wrestling with home. We're talking about all of humanity's wrestling with home through those three things. Will I have provision? Will I have connection? And will I have assurance about the future? And the Lord is going to step into Naomi's life and create a sense of home that she never would have imagined. Now, where we're picking up in chapter 3 is that there has been some time since Naomi and Ruth and Boaz have been doing the invisible work of God of creating a sense of home. Time has lapsed, and now Naomi is having her eyes focused on, we got to get Ruth a place of home, a place of rest, a place of security. So Naomi comes to Ruth and says, I got a game plan. And these first couple of verses probably don't show up in your YouVersion app or your Jesus calling on a normal day. And you'll see why here. Let's reread what was just read a second ago. Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, my daughter, I need to seek some security for you so that it may be well with you. Now, here is our kinsman, Boaz. Now, let me pause. If you're unfamiliar with the terminology of kinsman, there would be an ancient practice where if one of your family members fell on bad financial times, the last thing they could do was sell their land and give it away. Unless one other family member acted as a kinsman redeemer that basically said, I'm going to come in and I'm going to buy that land. I'm going to help you keep your security. And if they did that, they would be a kinsman redeemer. And that could operate under so many people within a family tree. So here's what Naomi's talking about. Now here is our kinsman Boaz, with whose the young women you have been working with. See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Now wash and anoint yourself. All right, I think it's time. I think we all did it. Can I have a microphone? Okay, how about now? Woo, okay, we're at full power. Full power up there, Mark. All right, here we go. Now, wash and anoint yourself and put on your best clothes and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to Boaz until he has finished eating and drinking. In other words, after he has had a very good time. When he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do. This is Naomi's plan. In my family, growing up, when we would watch movies, we had a policy. This was called the shield your eyes policy. And here's how it worked. We'd be watching a movie, and all of a sudden a scene would come on, and one of my parents would say, shield your eyes! And then they would cover my eyes. One of these movies I always remembered was the Titanic. There was a scene where they were talking about painting. And, you know, she was like, Jack, paint me like, shield your eyes! Never got to see what that scene was all about. Still don't. You hear the dialogue of Naomi, and you're like, oh my, are we about to have a shield your eyes kind of moment? And if you look at it very realistically, you think, my gosh, like what is she suggesting. And in this ancient kind of practice, this very twisted patriarchal kind of moment, you're just like, wow, is she about to offer the, what is going on here? And if you hear this story just alone, you may just hear this one moment. But I would like to suggest to you, because the Bible is not just stories, it's also a collective story, is that this is maybe a story worth moment. That it's one story that's coming after a line of stories. If you were hearing this story for the first time in Ruth, back as an ancient ear, you would hear Naomi's suggestion. You would immediately think, wait. I think I've heard this story already before. If you have a Bible with you, I'd like to invite you to take your finger, hold on to Ruth, and turn to the first book of the Bible, actually in Genesis. The first story that would come up would be this story in Genesis 19 that, quite frankly, is a very disturbing, strange, weird story. A lot of people who hold Bibles don't even know this story is in there, but it's a story about Lot and Lot's daughters, and their family has fallen on really hard times, and both of Lot's daughters do not have a son in which that will carry the line of their family. So the daughters come up with this plan where they say, okay, we need to carry on the family line, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to get dad really drunk, and then we're each going to sleep with him, and we will carry on the family line through it. Here's a couple verses here that describe this. So on the next day, one of the sisters said to the younger one, look, I laid last night with my father. Let us make him drink wine tonight also. Then you go in and lie with him so that we may preserve offspring through our father. So they made their father drink wine that night also, and the younger one rose and laid with him, and he did not know when she laid or when she rose. Thus both the daughters of Lot became pregnant by their father. And then at the very end of this story, you catch what the name is of one of the sons. And the older daughter had a son, and she named him who? Moab. He's the father of the Moabites today. Do you remember in the book of Ruth how Ruth is addressed? They say, it's Ruth the Moabite. Interesting. So you have Ruth's history being summed up in Genesis 19. There's a home that is disrupted. There's a woman who is without a child. There's a plan that is put in place. Someone is tricked. Someone sleeps with someone. And this is the line in which Ruth comes from. Now, hold on to that. Still hold your finger in Ruth. There would be one more story. If that one felt disturbing, buckle up. We got one more that's with us. This would be Genesis 38, the story of Judah and Tamar, which, if you're unfamiliar with this story, maybe it'd help to flip over to this. This would be a story where Judah has three sons, and Tamar marries the first son, and this first son passes, and the tradition would go that the next son would take Tamar, and that son passes, and then there's one more son waiting to see if Tamar will be able to bring a child through that marriage to continue the storyline. And Judah, out of fear, says, no, I've seen what happened with the first two sons. I don't think so. It's not going to happen. So Tamar, knowing that he is withholding that, decides to make a plan where she will actually fool him, and that she will actually take it into her own hands and be able to birth a son. So the third son, right here, when Tamar was told, your father-in-law is going up to the place where they shear sheep, she took off her widow's garments. Did we hear that? Put on a veil, wrapped herself up, and sat down at the entrance of this town. She saw that Shelah was grown up, yet she had not been given to him in marriage. When Judah saw her, this is in your Bible, folks. This is in your Bible. We're just reading the Bible right now. When Judah saw her, He thought her to be a prostitute, for she had covered her face. He went over to her at the roadside and said, "Come, let me come in to you," for he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. She said, "What will you give me that you may come into me?" And the story kind of finishes with, he does sleep with her. She does bear a son. And when the news comes out and Judah's like, "How dare you?" She's like, "It's your child." And he's like, "Oh, snap." That was a Zane Witcher translation. But this is the story of Judah and Tamar. Do you know who Judah's line continues? This story here. It's Boaz. You have the same story. Home is disrupted. There's a woman without a child. There's a conspired plan. Someone's tricked. Someone sleeps. And this is the story in which Boaz comes from. This is in the Bible. Now, it's worth probably stopping here because for some of us, if you're going to flannel graph this story, okay, which I don't know how you just lighten this thing, you say, "Wow, that was wild." If you're real and honest, you sit with the Bible and you go, "That's messed up. That's not right." It's not just uncomfortable. It's messy. Are you telling me that God's storyline would involve topics like incest or prostitution? What do you do with stories like that? And I think there's two things to recognize. One, you need to have some respect for the Bible because the Bible is raw and real. It's not talking about lives that are way far away that doesn't recognize the gravity, the messiness, the messed upness of humanity. And the second one, the one that maybe should make you shift in your seat a little bit and make you uncomfortable, is that this is the love of God. That there is no story that God turns down. No matter how messed up, no matter how uncomfortable, no matter how much we're like, shh, we don't talk about those things. That God doesn't turn his face. That he says, "If you invite me, I will enter into this story." And you may ask the question, why does the Lord do that? Because the Lord's different than you and I. He can literally hold compassion and conviction within his heart. Society will tell you, you get one or the other. You can be super compassionate, but you got to take away all the convictions. Or you'll have people that will be like, "You better be convicted, even at the cost of compassion," not the heart of God. The heart of God can handle both of them. I want to remind you, do you remember Mark 2, where Jesus is literally sitting with sinners and tax collectors? And it's church people who critique him to be like, "What? Why are you sitting with them? Why are you compassionate with them?" And do you remember what Jesus says to them? He doesn't get up from the table. "Oh, you're so right." They're like, "Ooh, no, no, no." No, he stays at the table and he goes, "Look, is it the healthy that need a doctor? Is it the righteous or the sinners that need me?" Which if you're sitting at the table with Jesus, you probably did a double take of like, "That's right, Jesus, get him. Wait a second, what'd you call me?" He holds compassion and he holds conviction. He can be compassionate while still holding his values. Why does God not turn down from stories? Because when stories are placed in God's hand, he can completely turn that story around. And that's what you find in Ruth chapter 3. Now, let's flip back over there, keeping these two stories in mind. When Boaz had eaten and was drunk and was in a content mood, he went to lie down at the heap of grain. Then she came, I love this translation, stealthily, quietly, like a ninja, and uncovered his feet and lay down. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and there, lying at his feet, was a woman. He said, "Who are you?" And she answered, "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your cloak over your servant, for you are next of kin." And Boaz said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. This last instance of your loyalty is better than your first. You have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not be afraid. I will do for you what you ask. For all the assembly of the people, in other words, the town, will know that you are a worthy woman. Now, take those two stories and listen again to this story. This is not a replay of these two awful stories before. This is actually God rewriting a story through Ruth and Boaz. Did you notice the trend? All the elements are there. Home's disrupted. There's a woman without a child, conspiring, tricked, sleep. This is a rough story. Ruth and Boaz, home is disrupted. There's a woman without a child. Ruth clothes herself differently. To be able to say wash and anoint would be take off the widow clothes and wear clothes that would signal a proposal. She trusts Boaz. For a woman to go out at dark, at night, to be around the grain pile would be a massive risk. Boaz is a powerful man. Boaz can do whatever Boaz wants to do in this moment. And Ruth actually trusts that Boaz will do the right thing. So takes the risk. And then, unlike the story of Judah and Tamar and Lot and his daughter, she asks. She says exactly what she is looking for. And Boaz matches her faithfulness. He doesn't sleep with her. He actually says, I see what you're trying to do. And I want to rewrite this story, create this sense of home for Naomi and for you and for us together. That's what he's talking about in verse 10. This last instance of your loyalty is better than the first. What he means by that is he's saying, I was blown away by what you were doing for Naomi already. And you're already going a step further. Keep in mind, Naomi just said, uncover his feet. We'll get back to that in a second. And then she said, just wait. Just see what happens. Ruth doesn't do that in verse 7. She's like, no, I'm going to take it into my own hands. I'm Ruth. I just hear I'm Groot every time, but I'm Ruth. And here's what I'm asking. I'm asking you to be our kinsman redeemer. I'm asking for something in this moment. I'm asking for a different story. What's beautiful about the Bible and seen in Ruth chapter 3 is that God will take not so great stories. God will take not so great histories. And he has the ability to turn them around into better stories. And a word for some of us in the church, he'll also take great stories and great legacies. And he'll make even greater stories out of them. If you come to church this morning and you feel like you come from a line or a family or a history that has not been a great story, that it's embarrassing to you, that you don't like to talk about it, that you feel shame about it, one of the things you need to hear, the gospel of Jesus Christ, is that God's love is inexhaustible for you, which means this: you will give up on yourself before God gives up on you. Whew. He won't give up. He will take not so great stories and he will build on them. He'll transform them. He'll change them. When you take your story and you hand it to God, any story that's placed in God's hands can tell a different story than the story of our parents, the story of our past, or the story of our pitfalls. You don't need to come with moral perfection. All you need to come with is messy desperation. Just set it before God and watch him start to transform. Now, I also want to talk to the other side of the room, because I know that there's some of us who would come and they'd be like, look, my history's great. I had a great family. Like, my family did great things, but my history, I've followed in the church. I've been in the church for a long time. And there's a word for you in Jesus Christ, that God's love is still inexhaustible for you as well, which means that God has more for your story. Not just to preserve your story. Well, don't mess this thing up, okay? You got it good growing up. Don't mess it up. No. He has more for you in this story. Do you notice in the story, Boaz asks Ruth, Who are you? And this is a massive, if you and I were sitting down with the text and we were doing some deep work, that would be a massive moment for Ruth. All throughout the book of Ruth, when people describe Ruth as Ruth the Moabite, as Ruth the outsider, as Ruth the gleaner, like all negative, Boaz gives her a moment to actually identify who she is. And you track the book of Ruth. Ruth, every time she identifies herself, is stronger and stronger each time. You want to know how to live a great story? Be an identity builder for other people in God's home. Look around. Look and see what God is doing in different people and call out that identity in them. The degree in which we build others up is the degree in which our roots go down. If we have found home here, you will find deeper and deeper home being an identity builder for other people. Because God's not just building a home, He's building a family. And it's a family that's built off of what Ruth and Boaz enter into. Now, we're in Ruth 3, so I got to recognize the elephant in the room that's been sitting there the whole time. You know the phrase, like, you picking up what I'm putting down? You smell what I'm stepping in? You tasting what I'm seasoning? Ruth 3 is making a hint at you. There is an elbow and there is a wink, okay? If you're not picking it up, I will say it overtly for you. This passage is highly sexually charged. It's a very intimate moment. We got threshing floor. We got change of clothes. We got what looks like a proposal. We got feet, which I'm thinking it's not actually feet. You know what I'm saying? There's all these different things that are being hinted at. And if you think it's provocative, the Bible's even more provocative than what you think that it's saying. Because it's setting you up for one of these shield your eyes moments. And what actually happens is something way deeper than two people taking off clothes. It's actually a moment where Ruth is sacrificing and trusting, and Boaz is sacrificing and trusting. There's a deeper intimacy that's happening here, and you can't be fooled or just focused on what you're seeing from the front. You actually have to look deeper into it. Ruth is giving over her life for Naomi to have connection. Ruth is taking a risk. Like I said, she's putting herself in a vulnerable spot because she trusts the character of who Boaz is. Boaz recognizes the risk that she's taking. And we will find in chapter 4, Boaz isn't even the first guy on the line that could be the kinsman redeemer. And he commits immediately to say, I will sacrifice to be able to make this happen. If someone else doesn't, it's a moment of vulnerability and sacrifice that creates home, family, holds the walls together. There's nothing else different when it comes to the church. That the church is this family, this mystery of people whose stories are housed in vulnerability and sacrifice to one another. Vulnerability, to actually risk putting yourself out there. Sacrifice, to say, I'm going to give a part of myself. I'm going to lay it out there for the flourishing of other people. This is the beauty. If you want to know, being a part of a church for a long time and engaging in it, the question of what's God going to do to me, if you fully engage, He's going to form you to be vulnerable, and He's going to form you to sacrifice. He's going to form you to be the type of person who knows what's happening in other people's stories, and people are going to know what's happening in your story. Which means to fully engage means we have to be a little bit vulnerable with each other. I know some of you are like, look, I don't share my life story. I'm not share. I don't do that. I get it. I'm not asking you to share your life story with everyone in the church. I am asking you to share this chapter with the church, with people around you who know you. That's a sense of vulnerability and sacrifice. I mean, we live in a world, good grief, Amazon is going to train us to where Everything in life is based off of time, convenience, and I'll stay signed up if it has something for me. And God's home will literally reorient us to move away from that type of thing. Church will always be a place of consumption instead of a furnace of transformation if we never enter into vulnerability and sacrifice with one another. It's what builds God's family, and it's what builds God's house. And remember what we said in the beginning. Small things end up making a story. Because Boaz is going to say at the end of chapter 3, you know, Ruth, I'm willing to do this. But there is another kinsman redeemer. If you back out of the biblical story, there is another kinsman redeemer, a family member who will take care, who will invite everyone into his family. And Matthew starts his gospel exactly like this. He says, the account of the genealogy of Jesus. Before I tell you the story of Jesus, I got to tell you about the people and their stories who came to make who Jesus is. And two of them that are mentioned is Tamar and Ruth. In other words, Jesus Christ enters the world. He's vulnerable. That word vulnerable literally means to wound. He made himself possible to be wounded, and we literally took our best shot as humanity in wounding him, placing him upon the cross. He was vulnerable, and he sacrificed. He gave up his life because there were some people in his lineage, generations before him, that were willing to sacrifice and be vulnerable for him, for us. Home is the story where God is taking the small things and he's pointing to his bigger story. Story of God is people like Ella and Sue, Brenda and Ashley. It's like Dwayne and Ryan. It's like Bill and Luke. It's all these small stories with small things happening side by side that actually tell the greater story of what God is doing. You want to enter God's house. You want to be formed. Vulnerability. Sacrifice. We're doing it oh so well. Let's not stop. Vulnerability. Sacrifice. Let's spend a moment praying.